This is Lance Lambert speaking, and this is my update for October 2006. As you are all no doubt aware, since my last update, much has happened in Israel and in the Middle East. In this update, I will seek to cover the recent war that lasted 34 days, the consequence of it, for the Middle East and in particular for Israel, the threat of Iran, the ongoing threat of Iran, and the salvation of the Muslims. Of course, as always, I am seeking to give this update basically in the light of God's Word. I have no doubt that many of you who pray for Israel and have a burden of intercession for her have followed very carefully the news, particularly in CNN and in Fox, were on the whole pretty objective, especially Fox. And you will have had many of the facts. What I want to be able to do is to cover the matters that you may not have heard, and particularly what God has to say about our present situation. I would like to turn to certain scriptures, and the first one is in the prophecy of Micah and chapter 4. Well, I'm going to read from verse 11. And now many nations are assembled against thee, that say, let her be defiled, and let our eye see our desire upon Zion. But they know not the thoughts of the Lord, neither understand they his counsel. For he hath gathered them as the sheaves to the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thy horn iron, and I will make thy hooves brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many peoples, and I will devote their gain unto the Lord, and their substance unto the Lord. And then in Hosea, the prophecy of Hosea, and chapter 2, and from verse 2, contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. And let her put away her whoredoms from her face, and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked, and set her as in the day that she was born, and make her as a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. Yea, upon her children will I have no mercy, for they are children of whoredom. For their mother hath played the harlot. She that conceived them hath done shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers that give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, mine oil and my drink. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her, that she shall not find her paths. And she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. And she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then it was better with me than now. And verse 14 and 15, therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. Speak, it says in the Hebrew, to her heart. And I will give her her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor, this is to do with Achan, for a door of hope. And she shall make answer there as in the days of her youth, and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishi, my husband, and shall not call me no more Baali, my Baal, or my owner. Then I would like to read the 83rd Psalm. O God, keep not silence, hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They take crafty counsel against thy people, and consult together against thy hidden ones. They have said, Come, and let us cut them off from being a nation. That the name of the Lord may be no more in remembrance, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent, against thee do they make a covenant, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagarines, Gabel and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre, Assyria also is joined with them. And then in verse 13, O my God, make them like the whirling dust, as stubble before the wind, as the fire that burns the forest, as the flame that sets the mountains on fire. So pursue them with thy tempest, and terrify them with thy storm. Fill their faces with confusion, that they may seek thy name, O Lord. That's salvation from amongst all these peoples, nearly all of them now Islamic. Let them be put to shame and dismayed forever, yea, let them be confounded and perish. That is what happens to those who will not be saved, that they may know that thou alone, whose name is the Lord, art the Most High over all the earth. Finally, I would like in the New Covenant to read in from the Roman letter of the Apostle Paul, chapter 11, and from verse 25. For I would not, brothers, have you ignorant of this mystery, lest you be wise in your own conceits, that a hardening in part has befallen Israel, until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And so all Israel shall be saved. Even as it is written, there shall come out of Zion the Deliverer. He shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. And this is my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins. As touching the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. But as touching the election, they are beloved for the patriarch's sake. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. As I have already mentioned, since my last update, Israel has passed through yet another war, her eighth war in the 58 years of her modern history. This conflict was marked by a more serious bombardment of northern Israel than any other war, except for the 1947-48 War of Independence, when there was much bombardment and damage in the country, and the 1982 war, the Lebanon War, which had seen previous to the beginning of that war, a bombardment particularly of the Galilee Panhandle and, of course, Nahariya along that border of Lebanon. And in the 1991 Gulf War, when 39 missiles were fired from Iraq. But except for these, and the War of Independence was the worst, there has never been a bombardment such as there has been in the north of Israel. The fact that one-sixth of the nation was evacuated, in Jerusalem, for instance, you could not but notice thousands of Galileans staying with relatives. We had one of our very close friends who had 30 relatives staying in his not-so-large home. We had others in our actual area that had 13 people staying with them. Just to give you an idea, 3,900 rockets fell in the north of Israel, with Naharia, Kiryat Shmona, and Haifa taking the worst. However, Hadera, Tzfat, Nazareth, Tiberias, Afula, Beit She'an, all had rockets. And this is not even to mention other places like Ma'olot and others too, many kibbutzim and moshavim. It all began in Gaza on the 25th of June with Hamas kidnapping an Israel Defense Forces corporal, Gilad Shalit. Hamas says it was not responsible for the kidnapping and tried to, it says, to get him freed. How much we can put on what Hamas says to Jews and to the world in general is questionable. They said that another small militia was responsible. Their statement does, in fact, reveal the general anarchy and lawlessness in both Gaza and the West Bank Palestinian areas. This became the occasion for a bombardment of Gaza and the Hamas government offices by the Israel Air Force, the Israel Defense Forces, and the Israel Navy. And Israel had suffered some 1,000 Qassem rockets fired into her territory from Gaza since the Gaza pullout, and more, and many more since. On the 12th of July, Hezbollah kidnapped two Israel Defense Force soldiers, Ehud Goldwasser and Eldad Regev, and killed three others. Ehud Olmert declared that this was an act of war, and the war commenced. Almost immediately, the Israel Air Force went into action and destroyed all bridges and roads linking Syria to Lebanon and put out of action the Beirut International Airport. The Israel Navy then blockaded the whole seacoast of Lebanon. Within days, the infrastructure of Lebanon was paralyzed, if not destroyed. The aim was to stop all re-equipping of Hezbollah from sea, air, and land. Another basic aim of this bombardment was to try to keep the two kidnapped soldiers within Lebanon, because Ron Arad, who has been for so many decades in their hands, was spirited out of Lebanon to Iran. The south of Lebanon, basically, for all intents and purposes, is Hezbollah country. And it was bombarded, and the Hezbollah headquarters and stronghold in South Beirut leveled. During the campaign, the official report tells us that the Israel Air Force flew 1,200 combat missions, whilst the Navy fired 2,500 shells. 400 miles of roads were destroyed, 73 bridges, 31 strategic targets, including Beirut International Airport. And now I add, naturally, large parts of the Lebanese civilian infrastructure were also destroyed. The Lebanese government, led by the Prime Minister Fuad Siniora, made a great noise, quite understandably from their point of view. However, it must be remembered that the Lebanese government, whether pro-Syrian or so-called moderate as at present, has never tried to curb Hezbollah. For instance, the UN United Nations resolutions of 1559 from 2004 and 1680 required the disarming of, that was from 2006, required the disarming of all armed groups in the Lebanon and the Lebanese government and army to be the only authority in the Lebanon. The Lebanese government did absolutely nothing about these resolutions and allowed Hezbollah to expand without any curb or hindrance. Hezbollah thus became a state within a state, with the best equipped and best trained militia in the Middle East, its standard infinitely superior to most, if not all, of the armies of the Middle East states. It has good, uncorrupt officers and an intense ideological commitment on the part of its soldiers. Hezbollah has been financed, equipped, and trained by Iran, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, the spearhead of the Islamic Revolution, as it is called, were the officers who trained Hezbollah. And Syria acted as the willing conduit and helper. Hezbollah has always stated publicly that it only wanted Israel out of Lebanese territory, and that once Israel withdrew, it would cease all military operations. When Israel withdrew to the international border, it then took up the small enclave of the Sheva farms as its reason for continuing military operations. The Sheva farms, situated on the slopes of Mount Hermon, are in fact disputed territory between Syria and Lebanon, both laying claim to it. However, Hezbollah states clearly within its constitution, as is the case also with Hamas, it calls for the complete liquidation of Israel, and I think in this context, very importantly, and the reconstitution of the Lebanon as an Islamic fundamentalist state. The reason no Lebanese government was prepared to confront Hezbollah is simple. They have been afraid of a renewal of the civil war which killed thousands of Lebanese. Hezbollah accounts for some 40% of Lebanese. The increase in their number principally due to the large families that the Shia have. It has also two members of parliament in the present moderate government and one minister in the cabinet. On the 28th of July, in a poll conducted by an Arab source, only 8% felt the United States supported the Lebanon, whilst 87% of those polled supported Hezbollah's fight with Israel. This does not bode well for Israel. For if this poll is accurate, or even only near accurate, Hezbollah is more popular than ever with the Lebanese and could be mere steps away from becoming the government. In this war, the world in general, and Israel in particular, was surprised to find how well the Hezbollah militia fought. It is, of course, a guerrilla force, which means that it hides within the civilian population and the general landscape. These attacks by small, well-armed units cause serious problems for the IDF, especially where hundreds of sophisticated Russian-made anti-tank guided missiles, ATGMs, were used. They enabled Hezbollah to destroy 14 Israeli Merkava main battle tanks. 6 tanks were destroyed by anti-tank mines. Additional casualties were caused by Hezbollah using ATGMs to collapse buildings onto Israeli troops sheltering inside. One of our top newspapers, Haaretz, reported that Hezbollah was a trained, skilled, well-organized, highly motivated infantry that is equipped with the cream of the crop of modern weaponry from the arsenals of Syria and Iran. For Israel to deal properly with a guerrilla force such as Hezbollah requires both time and a special strategy. But Israel had little time with the United Nations, Russia, and the European Union pressurizing her for a ceasefire. With even the United States and the United Kingdom, though much more understanding of the problem, still urging Israel toward a ceasefire. We have to say also that if she had little time, she had even less strategy, or that's how it appears to us. This, compounded with the indecisiveness of the Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and the Defence Minister Amir Peretz, led to an unsuccessful campaign with no proper conclusion. If Arik Sharon had only not been in a comatose state, this war could have had a very different outcome. I see this also as the hand of God in our present history. The indecisiveness of the present government can be seen in the simple fact that once a ceasefire had been accepted by both parties, that is Israel and Hezbollah, then both went all out in the last 24 hours. For Israel, it resulted in 32 soldiers losing their lives, all in order to occupy as much high ground as possible, a job that should have been completed much earlier. Now, I have not mentioned the Lebanese side of things. Our side was bad enough, with so many homes destroyed, property damaged, and lives lost. But if we lost 44 civilians and some 1,400 approximately badly injured, the Lebanese side of the story is much worse. Well over 1,000 died, and many more thousands were injured, and much of the south of the country was rendered uninhabitable by bombardment, let alone the south of Beirut. What are the consequences of all of this? Both Israel and Hezbollah claimed victory. The Lebanon celebrated with fireworks and went wild. On the other hand, Ehud Olmert pointed to the fact that Hezbollah has now been pushed back to the River Litani, and a United Nations-supervised force would be stationed between Israel and Hezbollah. He also pointed to the new UN Resolution 1701, particularly the provision that there be no armed militias in Lebanon other than the Lebanese army. The ceasefire is actually based on this UN Resolution 1701, which calls for an international arms embargo against Hezbollah. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Mark Regev said on August the 19th, in the absence of that presence, arms transfers to Hezbollah are a clear violation of 1701, and Israel is entitled to respond. When the international forces and the Lebanese army are enforcing the embargo, Israeli action becomes superfluous. On the 27th of August, Kofi Annan, the UN General Secretary, said that UN troops would not intercept Syrian arms equipment to Hezbollah unless requested to do so by the Lebanese government. On August the 21st, the Turkish newspaper Hurriyet reported that Turkish authorities intercepted 5 Iranian cargo aircraft and 1 Syrian aircraft carrying missiles to Hezbollah. The aircraft were forced to land at Diyarbakir Airport in southeastern Turkey. The aircraft were not allowed to take off after U.S. intelligence sources found there were 3 missile launchers and crates of C-802 missiles on board the planes, which were identical to the missile that struck the Israeli naval ship Hanit during the war. Shortly after the resolution was adopted, Hezbollah said it was not in favour of being disarmed. Lebanon said that it would not disarm Hezbollah, and the United Nations indicated it would also not disarm Hezbollah. We have, I think, quite a serious situation if this resolution is going to go the way of all the other resolutions, which is that it is basically a piece of paper which is to be ignored. The fact, however, is very simple and stark. The south of Lebanon is basically Hezbollah's territory, and being a guerrilla-type force, their men can simply blend back into village life to await further calls to action. The general populace in south Lebanon is solidly behind Hezbollah, and very proud of them. The Lebanese army, on the other hand, has long since lost its teeth. Ever since the president-elect Bashir Gemayel was murdered by the Syrian Secret Service with 21 other Lebanese Maronite leaders, it has deteriorated. Today, the Lebanese army has a large Shia constituency. Then again, we need to add 3 more constituents: the appalling weakness of the United Nations, secondly, its bad record in the Middle East in particular, and thirdly, the fact that its resolutions are rarely implemented. Has the United Nations ever been successful in the Middle East? Has its resolutions ever been heeded? One remembers the Six-Day War in 1967, when Nasser gave the United Nations force, peacekeeping force in the Sinai, 48 hours to get out, and the United Nations peacekeeping force left with such indecent haste that it was out within 24 hours. Ehud Olmert declared that this conflict was a decisive victory for Israel and that it would be proved to all in the days ahead. Certainly, The Lebanon did not see it that way, nor the Arab world, not to mention the Islamic world. They all pronounced it as a decisive victory for Hezbollah, and the first time an Arab militia had beaten the invincible Israelis. There was rejoicing throughout the whole Islamic world. To be honest and objective, one can hardly describe this war as a dramatic and decisive victory for Israel. In fact, it has left Israel confused and to a certain extent demoralized. There are many unanswered questions. Why did it take so long for the order to be given to reach the River Litani? Was the pounding of the Lebanon such a good operation, especially propaganda-wise? Who was so indecisive? Was it Ehud Olmert, the Prime Minister, or Amir Peretz, the Defense Minister, or Dan Halutz, the Commander-in-Chief of the whole? Who? The whole of Israel has been filled with discussion. The television, radio, newspapers have been full of questions and heated discussions. For the first time, Israeli reservists demonstrated outside government offices, asking why they were so properly equipped, why very often orders given were countermanded within hours, and so that they felt that nobody quite knew what they were supposed to do, who was responsible for the indecisiveness of the campaign, why were the tanks not brought up to date with better armor, and many more such questions. 119 soldiers gave their lives and more than 400 maimed for a United Nation resolution that will probably be, as I have said, a piece of paper in the United Nations archives, like 1559 and 1680. It is, of course, true that it was only in the last few days that the IDF began to move powerfully into the Lebanon, both from the southern Lebanese border and by parachuting commandos into the River Litani area, thus encircling Hezbollah. The question being asked is over who was responsible, Olmert, Peretz, or Halutz. And as always, every one of them believes the others were responsible. There are many calls for an independent inquiry and not the usual type adopted by politicians worldwide in order to cover up the truth. If there was, I ought to add in connection with this, that in the last few days there was a huge demonstration in Tel Aviv with over 30,000 demonstrators calling for a truly independent national inquiry into this conflict and into its management. The consequences of all this is that Hezbollah has been handed, another thing I ought to say is, if there was an election now, I would not for one moment expect Kadima to win. That is the general feeling in Israel. This, after all, was a war with only three previous wars like it. I have, in fact, already drawn attention to this. Those wars were the War of Independence, the Lebanon War, and the Gulf War of 1991. This time, the whole of the north of Israel came under bombardment, with the loss of what I have mentioned, 44 civilian lives, and more than 1,350 injured. Much damage to property, estimated at between $1.6 billion to $3 billion US dollars. It is The environmental consequences were also very great, with forests decimated, especially in the Kiryat Shmona area. One forest alone was 75% destroyed. It has been estimated that it will take at least 60 years to rehabilitate the forests alone. To this we might add that for the first time, 1/6 of the Israeli population was evacuated. It is inconceivable that this war ended with yet another UN resolution and Hezbollah claiming victory. The consequences of all this is that Hezbollah has been handed a huge propaganda victory. And as a result, Israel is in a no-win situation. This is serious, if only because once the Arabs believe they have won such a war, they will become far more belligerent and demanding. It has always been the case. Hezbollah will rearm one way or another. Both Iran and Syria will see to that, whatever they publicly say or promise. For Israel, it would be better if the next round was to come soon, whilst Hezbollah is somewhat weakened and disorganized. The longer Israel waits, the more serious the problem will become. The next round, if it is left for a year or two, will undoubtedly bring the whole of Israel into its range, and with much better and more precise weapons. Interestingly, the Arab League believes the roadmap is dead as a result of the war and are going to produce a new plan to be presented to the United Nations. Ehud Olmert says that his plan, the plan upon which Kadima was elected and now named Convergence, has gone to the bottom of the pile. There is no doubt that it would be almost impossible to sell it in the present mood of Israel. It has become clear that the withdrawal from South Lebanon some years ago and the withdrawal from Gaza last year, upon both of which we were promised rocket-free peace and prosperity, has never materialized. In fact, Israel has had nothing but more rockets and now a war. The Israeli public has simply recognized that any further withdrawal in the West Bank and the Golan will render the whole of Israel unsafe. The source of all this trouble is, in my mind, Iran. The facts that I have seen convince me that the nerve center is the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Both Hezbollah and Hamas are supported by Iran, and Syria is in a strategic alliance with Iran. The enormous Islamic Shia revival, which has produced the present Iran we know, has spread to both Iraq and to the Lebanon, producing a Shia arc or crescent extending from Pakistan and Afghanistan to Iran and then to Iraq, bringing Syria into its orbit. The ruling establishment in Syria is basically Alawi, a sect within the Shia, and ending in the Lebanon. Out of this Shia revival, Hezbollah was born. When one understands the enormous and bitter gulf between the Sunnis and the Shia, one can also understand how Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, all of them Sunni, are much troubled by this development. Al-Qaeda, which means the base, its full title, which is never given in the world media, being the base for holy war, jihad, against Jews and Crusaders, Crusaders being the term for Christians, is a Sunni movement. Osama bin Laden is a Sunni, the founder of Al-Qaeda, who greatly respects the Shia Islamic Revolution in Iran. Zawahri, this deputy leader, is also an Egyptian Sunni. A few days ago, Zawahri made another video shown on the anniversary of the 9/11 disaster in New York and declaring that Israel and the Gulf states would be the next target. Between the Shia Islamic Revival and Revolution and the Sunni Wahhabi Revival, which has produced Al-Qaeda, there are few Muslim governments that are not threatened. It is, after all, not merely the West which is threatened, but moderate, benign Islam and its governments. The 9/11 attack, the London and Madrid bombings, the foiled plan to blow up some 10 airliners bound for the US will be peanuts compared to an Iran with a nuclear bomb, with a nuclear Pakistan already walking a tightrope held to a pro-West stance by its president, Musharraf, and the Pakistan army. But one wonders for how long. The outlook is bleak indeed. President Ahmadinejad has repeatedly stated his determination to wipe Israel off the world map. Nor is that rhetorical hot air. There are serious grounds for believing that Iran has a military nuclear program running parallel with its civilian nuclear program, but undercover. Furthermore, there can be no doubt that Iran will first use such a weapon on Israel before settling debts with the USA, with the United Kingdom and other Western countries. Nor will appeasement by European countries such as France or Italy or Denmark, Norway and Sweden save them in such a confrontation. They are all considered crusader nations to be overcome, defeated, and converted to Islam. Western civilization has no one else but itself to blame if this terrible scenario becomes historical fact. George Bush and Tony Blair are the only world leaders with the Australian leader who seem to recognize the problem, the gravity of this problem. Both of them are held up to ridicule as icons of stupidity, as warmongers, whilst in fact they have shown in this matter some statesmanship in their refusal to compromise with evil. Of course, George Bush and Tony Blair are both coming toward the end of their terms as leaders. Tony Blair saying that within a year he will step down and allow his successor to lead the nation. It is interesting to note the consistent portrayal of these two men, and indeed of John Howard of Australia, by the left-wing media as non-entities. In my estimate, it says something about the present character of the Western world. Let me speak for myself. I find it amazing that one is watching a replay of the 1930s. The same appeasement of evil, the same refusal to believe that evil men, demonized men, are indeed evil and demonized, the same belief that the statements made by these leaders are merely rhetorical hot air, and that once they get what they want, they will calm down and become balanced, moderate leaders. The same blindness to the build-up of armories and weapons and men. The same seeking to find a modus vivendi with such darkness. The same idea that the Jews, and now Israel in particular, deserve what they're going to get. I find this amazing. Only one lion of a man stood alone through those years, repeatedly warning of what was coming upon Europe and the world. He was ridiculed and held up as a warmonger. That man was Winston Churchill. He was proved right, and the rest now recognized as blind. I have the same feeling that we are witnessing the same process, with very few able to stand up for what is morally right. It was the same ground that caused so many to believe that peace at any price was right. It was the idea that war is itself evil. Well, of course, there's nothing beautiful about war. But to me, it is extraordinary that a country like Czechoslovakia, as it then was sacrificed cynically by a man who was called a Christian leader and a defender of Christian civilization, Neville Chamberlain. When it came to it, he sacrificed Czechoslovakia for a so-called peace. It never came. Within years, Europe and the world were locked in a world war. I can't help feeling that we're in much the same way. The anti-war feeling in Britain, the anti-war feeling in Europe, the anti-war feeling in Canada, the anti-war feeling in the United States even. I find it very interesting that there seems to be an idea that anything that avoids a confrontation with evil is a path worth travelling. It will lead only to war and to, I think, a terrible unpreparedness for it. Compromise never, ever pays dividends. It is significant that Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, refused to give answer to the Europeans or the British until August the 22nd. And whilst that date passed without any trouble, the choice of it is filled with the most sombre significance. It is first the date that in the Christian year, August the 22nd, corresponds to the Islamic calendar to the date the 27th of Rajab, 1427. The night that Muhammad is supposed to have ascended to heaven from Jerusalem on his winged horse Al-Burak. It is also, secondly, the day that Salah ad-Din defeated the Crusaders and took back Jerusalem for Islam. Thirdly, according to Islamic tradition, it is the day when the Muslim Messiah, the Imam Mahdi, will return to the earth. And fourthly, it is also the day when the crescent moon is seen in conjunction with the one star, which is the normal symbol of Islam. The message is simple. Islam is on a victory roll. It believes that it has a divine, divinely given agenda, and has a divine destiny to fulfill. It will defeat and liquidate the Jews, liberate Jerusalem, and conquer the so-called Christian nations. The amazing fact is that nearly every one of the Western nations now has a growing Muslim population. And whilst the majority of those Muslims are decent, hard-working, peace-loving people, buried within them are the militants, the fundamentalist militants, who believe firmly in this Quranic agenda. These communities will in the end become, as is clear already, to be the base for much of the trouble that will come upon such nations. Ahmadinejad believes that he is the forerunner of the Shia Messiah, the Mahdi, the 12th Imam. Although a number of the Ayatollahs wonder whether President Ahmadinejad is not the Mahdi himself, this in itself represents real danger. It is the same spirit that mesmerized and energized Adolf Hitler, with fatal consequences for the whole world. Hitler believed that he had a divine destiny to be the savior of the world, particularly the Western world. He wanted to see a return to Hellenic and Roman principles. He despised utterly Christianity and hated with a violent hatred the Judaism. His simple solution to the problem was that all those who were subhuman or in any so compromised by intermarriage and interracial mixture was to get rid of them and thus produce a pure stock for the world. The fact that he believed there was some divine destiny in it only made the whole matter far more complex and far more difficult. As I have said, Ahmadinejad believes that he is the forerunner of the Muslim Messiah and believes that, he is coming soon. Thus, on the 22nd of August, Iran said it would go on with the enriching of uranium and will produce heavy water. If we take all these elements together, the message is clear. Western civilization is facing one of the most serious threats to its very existence ever made. Twice before, Western civilization, whether you call it Judeo-Christian or whatever, has faced the same threat. The first in the 8th century, which climaxed in the Battle of Tours, when the Muslim forces from Spain should have dealt a death blow to the vastly smaller Christian forces. But Charles Martel, by the grace of God, won the battle. It is interesting just to consider for a moment that if that battle of Tours, 200 miles from Paris, had in fact gone as it should for Islam, then the whole of Europe would have been Islamic, the British Isles would have been Islamic, the original pilgrims that were forced out of the British Isles and sailed to the New World would have been probably Shia Muslims fleeing from Sunni Muslims, and the whole of North America would have been Muslim. It is interesting. It is the hand of God in history. And we see it again in the Battle of Vienna in the 17th century, when it looked as if once more the whole of Europe would fall to vastly superior Islamic forces led by the Ottomans. It was at their height. It climaxed in the Battle of Vienna, when the whole of Europe trembled, and in the most incredible manner, God gave the victory to the Christians. I think we have reached another such point in history, and now here we are with a huge force in the world. One out of every five human beings is a Muslim. Now, I do not want what I've said to be used in any shape or form against Muslims in a wrong way. I am simply trying to explain the situation as it is. The vast majority of these Muslims are benevolent, benign, hard-working, decent people who just want to live in peace. But those who believe in the original agenda, the Quranic agenda, they believe that the world has to be taken by Islam. And it is interesting to me that the Ayatollah Khomeini, now dead for a number of years, who led the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the successful Islamic Revolution, always said that the first step in this was the destruction of Israel. And after Israel was destroyed, then the rest of the Christian world would be taken. He believed that Israel, he called it the little Satan, was produced by Satan with the permission of Allah as a judgment upon the lukewarmness of the Muslim masses, and that Allah would use Israel to provoke the Islamic masses to become shaheeds. We call them today suicide bombers, martyrs. They would lay down their lives for Allah and for the cause, the Quranic cause. This is precisely what we are witnessing. And he said, when there are enough Muslims who will rise up and become shaheeds, martyrs, then God would give them Israel. They would liberate Jerusalem, liquidate the Jews, and go on to the conquest of the world. I've said this a number of times in different tapes, updates over the years, but it's worth saying it again, because I think we are now in a confrontation with darkness. Nor can you get rid of these people before their time. Everybody says, why don't they get Osama bin Laden? Why don't they get Zawahiri? Why not? Because God does not allow it. That's why. Just in the same way they could not get rid of Hitler or Stalin. These men have an allotted time, and it is destined by God. So in my estimation, we are now facing a tremendous matter in this. What is to me appalling is that the church is asleep, including a large majority of evangelicals. They're asleep, completely embroiled in clapping, dancing, and I don't know what. I've nothing against dancing and nothing against clapping, and certainly nothing against true worship, but I find it incredible that the church is basically in cotton wool, ensconced in some kind of delusion. If we're saved, if we're born of God, if we're alive to God, if we've been made alive to Him, surely our eyes should be open. But except for someone like my very good friend David Pawson, nobody has sounded a warning. And when he did, he got thoroughly shot down by his fellow evangelicals. Over the 22nd of August, Iran's answer could not be made more clear. She indulged in nationwide war games. Was this, as they claim, merely to bring their defences up to scratch, or were they serious manoeuvres in preparation for another stage that Allah would lead them into? There is no doubt in my mind that we in the Middle East, in Israel in particular, and on the wider level, the Western world, are in a build-up to something far more serious than has thus far been understood. The war on terror is but the prelude to something much bigger. It is time for believers to wake up, especially those who know the value of prayer and those who are intercessors. If we take Iran in her present state and the Al-Qaeda network worldwide and the belief of millions of young militant and fundamentalist Muslims that the final war in world history is upon us, in which all Jews will be liquidated along with Israel and all Christians either converted to Islam or destroyed, the scene before us is indeed somber. And yet we should not be downcast. It is very interesting to me to remember this wonderful prophecy in Micah chapter 4. Some will say, of course, this was fulfilled because it speaks of Zion like a woman in travail. This is Micah chapter 4 and verse 10, and it says that she will come even unto Babylon, and there shalt thou be rescued. There will the Lord redeem thee from the hand of your enemies. Now, people naturally will say straight away, well, all this was fulfilled. But the principle is always the same. There is this hatred towards Zion and to what she stands for. And the Lord says, but they know not the thoughts of the Lord. This is the nations. Neither understand they his counsel. That's absolutely true. For he hath gathered them as the sheaves to the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thy horn iron, and I will make thy hooves brass. I find this very amazing. It says in Numbers 23 and verse 9 that this is a people that shall dwell alone. They shall not be numbered amongst the nations. In other words, they are unique. And although I know there are those who believe all that is over and finished with, the fact of history, the facts of history, I think, tell us a different story. The evidence that this people have survived, and that they have survived in so remarkable a manner, is after massacre after massacre, persecution after persecution, I think it is incredible. And I can only say this, that this unsaved people are much like the trees that God put in the Garden of Eden. People argue about what the tree was. That's not neither here nor there. The fact of it was God put it there and said this will divide between those who will take the tree of life and those who will take the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And it's just the same with this Jewish people who are so like any other nation in many ways, who look like other people. It's incredible to me that this people are the dividing point of history. And everything that in one way handles this people wrongly, or curses them, or resists them, or tries to suppress them, they themselves are cursed. They themselves are suppressed. They themselves fall apart. We've seen it with the British Empire. We've seen it with the Ottoman Empire. We've seen it with the Soviet Empire. And now we have the Islamic Empire. I mean, I think it is incredible that this people that the Lord said to Zion, arise, thresh, in her weakest point, when everyone was against her, when she was in Babylon, when it seemed as if all was finished, all was destroyed in the Holy Land, here is the Lord saying, arise, thresh. I believe that this is exactly what is happening. That's what worries me about the roadmap that Mr. Bush supports. That's what worries me about Tony Blair's pioneering of this roadmap. His visit just now to Jerusalem, in which he tried to jumpstart the peace process again. He got a very unpleasant welcome in the Palestinian areas and in the Lebanese areas. But Olmert had with him, he had a good reception in Israel. I find it very interesting, this whole thing. We are therefore at a point in history where we need to wake up. My feeling is that basically the church is asleep. Israel is indeed unsaved, for the most part blind. There is enough sin in Israel, enough immorality, enough abortion, enough of everything to warrant enormous judgment. And yet God, in his mercy and grace, has somehow determined that this people will in the end be saved. And I find it incredible that the Apostle Paul prophesies in his letter to the Romans when he said, you must understand, my brothers, that a hardening in part has befallen Israel until the time the full number of the Gentiles become in. And so all Israel shall be saved. That is also those, I think, from the Gentiles, who are saved by the grace of God. They are the wild olive branches in the natural olive tree. But the natural branches will also come back to their own tree. Now, I find this quite incredible when he says that, as touching the gospel, they are enemies for your sake, but as touching the election, the predestinating will and counsel of God, they are beloved for the patriarch's sake. The covenants that some say have been superseded and nullified. Why does it say, for the patriarch's sake? God made covenants with them, and those covenants he is keeping. So I find it incredibly interesting to see where we are in this thing. Are we not toward the end of the great gospel endeavor? There's still work to be done, much work to be done, but we are coming toward the fullness of the Gentiles, the full number of those that are to be saved. And if that is the case, then the Lord is going to turn back to us. And now that's why I find Hosea so interesting. I believe this little passage in Hosea throws a flood of light upon our present situation in Israel and the Middle East. For there the Lord says, you know, Israel is, she is a wife that has gone astray. She has gone into whoredom, immorality. She's given herself to every kind of principality and power, following this, following that, following the other. And the Lord says, very well, I will hedge up her way with thorns and build a wall against her so she cannot find her paths. I find that a flood of light upon our present situation. The withdrawal from Lebanon, mistake. The withdrawal from Gaza, a mistake. What are we doing? We're following our lovers, the United Kingdom, the European Union, the United States, trying somehow or other to appease them, to follow their ideas and concepts. And what happens? We get nothing. Nothing but trouble, injury, and death. And basically hatred in the world. I think it is interesting that every attempt that Mr. Sharon and Mr. Olmert have made over the past year or two have ended in nothing. In trouble. It is the Lord hedging up Israel's way with thorns and building a wall against her so she cannot find these paths, the road map to peace. I think it is wonderful that the Lord's in charge of this whole thing. And I believe that it has to continue. So if we praise the Lord, when we read this 83rd Psalm, every one of the nations around us is in that little psalm. It is incredible, incredible. They consult together, they make a covenant together that they will destroy the name of Israel, that it shall cease to be a nation and that her name will disappear from history. Isn't it amazing that this psalm was written some 3,000 years ago, between 2,000 and 3,000 years ago, and here we have almost a prophetic window into what is happening. Nothing is new under the sun. It is the same hatred and, very interestingly, the same peoples. And the Lord will do something. Now here I must end. But I must end with something wonderful. President Ahmadinejad, in all the bad things he said one thing that was marvellous. On radio or television, he actually said 600 Iranian Muslims a month are being converted to Christianity. Now, I have friends here in Athens are much in this refugee work. And there are three assemblies, Iranian, Farsi-speaking assemblies here, would you believe it? Many of the Muslims who've come to the Lord, and they all say that if Iran was free, one of the greatest awakenings in the history of the church would take place. It is exciting to see young people coming to the Lord and being fearless, ready to die for their faith. It's not just Iran. I mean, Ahmadinejad said this, but our friends who are Iranian tell us that it's three times that figure a month. They reckon that it's at least double to three times that figure that are coming to the Lord. The same thing is happening in Bangladesh. The same thing is happening in Indonesia. The same thing is happening to a lesser extent in Pakistan. It is very interesting that everywhere in Central Asia, the Stans, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, something is happening. There's like a rumble. Last year, I spoke at Tom Hess's Convocation of the Nations, and at the end of it, Kazakhs came to me. They wanted to dress me up in a patriarch's dress of the Kazakhs. There were five of these dear men, if not six, and they were all pastors. And if I understood rightly, they were all pastors or leaders of some assemblies, numbering up to 1,000. And they said to me, one of them said to me, tens of thousands of Kazakhs are coming to the Lord. Now, that may be an exaggeration, I don't know, but even if it was only 5,000 coming to the Lord, it would, to me, be amazing. When I remember the people that I worked with in Egypt for 3 years, who could count sometimes on the fingers of one hand after a lifetime of service and ministry, those Muslims who'd come to the Lord. They all believed that there would come a day when a great harvest would come. When the Lord spoke to me in 1986, predicting that, revealing to me that the Soviet Union would collapse and be no more because God would judge it for her wickedness, and out of the Soviet Union would come thousands upon thousands to the Lord Jesus and would go out to the world. I remember the Lord also said to me that he would similarly judge and break Islam, and that out of Islam would come a harvest of young men and women born of the Spirit and filled with the Spirit and anointed by the Spirit to testify to the Lord Jesus. I find this just tremendous. That's the only word I can use for it. If the outlook is somber and bleak, thank God the Lord is sovereign and he's got everything under control. A harvest is coming out of this. As it says in that prophecy of Joel, and whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. In the midst of turmoil, of restlessness, of persecution, of darkness, of a rejection of the Bible and its principles, the gospel, out of it will come an army for the Lord. I have no doubt about it. No doubt at all. I think that there are two peoples that we shall see a tremendous thing. I could almost say three. But there were two peoples, at least, that I believe we shall see an enormous harvest out of, the Jews and the Muslims. And I would not surprise me if the Lord saves so many Muslims and fills them with a love for the Jewish people and for Israel, that in some extraordinary way would somehow ignite something within the Jewish heart. The third group will be the Chinese. I have no doubt about it. A huge harvest will come out of China. Dear brother, dear sister, don't give up. Don't be depressed. Don't be downcast. There are more wars to come in Israel and much more suffering. But the Lord has a purpose, and that purpose is salvation. He says some very harsh things in Hosea as to what he will do, but it is all summed up in those words, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and will speak to her heart. How God will speak to the heart of Israel or the Jewish people, I do not know. But it has to mean something tremendous. Not to the head, to the heart. And in that speaking, there will come vision. And with that vision will come recognition. And with that recognition will come salvation.